Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here with Jess Commuterson. Jess, how are you tonight?
Hey, Josh. I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. For those, if this is your first time joining us, we are the Legal Geeks. And tonight, we are here to journey into mystery, to talk about one of the greatest comic book heroes ever, the mighty Thor. And a little gender bending that's happened. But that's...
Which has made him much more interesting. Made Thor much more interesting.
You know, I've read Thor since I was a young teen, and you're a relatively new fan, and we've both talked about the legal issues in the latest two issues of Thor. And it's the first time that we both have tackled effectively the same topic from different perspectives. And so, Jessica, what are your thoughts on the property rights associated with Mjolnir, Thor's hammer?
Ooh, good job pronouncing it. I'm always afraid to pronounce it, so I had to say the hammer. First of all, I do want to clarify one thing. I am a new fan of the Thor comics, but Norse mythology was actually one of my first loves growing up in northern Minnesota. We're like, we don't need Greek mythology. We're all Norwegian. So I grew up reading about Norse mythology. But even there, Thor was the easiest. And he was like a third grader. I'm like, Thor's a moron and Loki can trick him into anything. So I liked Freya. I liked Baldur. I liked Odin. I liked Loki. But Thor, I thought, was kind of boring. You know, he's the big lunkhead who Loki was always tricking with a quick temper. And so maybe that kind of lack of interest transferred over to the comics, where Thor was never a character I was really interested in. But now they are doing this fantastic stuff. Obviously, I'm obviously a big, like, girl action hero kind of fan. So, you know, when they started time with this female Thor, I'm like, I have to check it out. Started reading them, love them, but didn't really see any legal issues until, of course, Thor Odinson shows up in issue 4 and is like, I want my hammer back. And so it got me thinking, obviously, and you kind of touched on this, the hammer is not your typical personal property. But I'm like, okay, if it is, you know, would there be, if these Norse gods bother to consult with a lawyer, would there be issues? I, of course, had to look under Minnesota law because we are like the most Scandinavian of all the states. And I think, I didn't find this, but I'm pretty sure that Minnesota has more Swedes and more Norwegians outside of Norway and Sweden than like anywhere else in the world. So anyway, that little digression into my home state history. But there is this concept in Minnesota and actually other states too about theft of lost property, which in other words, it kind of prevents you from like, oh, hey, I found this incredibly valuable piece of property on the sidewalk. Oh, no one's around. Guess it's mine. They're saying, no, you do need to make efforts. And this is kind of the idea you hear about where if you find a bunch of money on the sidewalk, you're supposed to turn it into the police. If nobody claims it, then you can get it back kind of thing. So that was the same idea about, you know, could she return the hammer to its owner. Josh, your point?
Yeah, let's back up a moment because there might be some lawyers and law students who are not reading the series.
Oh, I'm back. Oh, that's right. All right, sorry. I'm jumping through too much. But why don't you give the background? You're more of the comic expert than I am.
Okay, will do. So in the last issue of Original Sin, there's a fight with the now aged Nick Fury. The Infinity Serum is worn off. It turns out he's been waging a secret war, killing aliens and demons since apparently the late 50s, early 1960s, on an interdimensional level, fighting the, you know, battles that kept galactic wars from taking place. And that's the entire premise of the series. So in this fight in orbit between Thor and Nick Fury, Fury says something to Thor in a whisper. And in that whisper, Thor reacts in rage with, what? What did you say? And in that instant, he becomes unworthy of the hammer. And the hammer drops and lands on the moon. When the Thor series picks up, we have Thor on the moon, who's been trying to pick up the hammer for God knows how long. Odin can no longer lift it either, which is huge. So there is, and we still don't know what was said, so there's still some mystery there. Whatever it is, it's truly bothered Thor Odinson immensely. And that's just the background of after the Asgardians leave to go fight Norse giants, or excuse me, frost giants that are on Earth causing problems, and others go back to Asgardia, we have a female hand that's seen that's able to pick up the hammer. Now, I don't know how she could get to the moon and not explode without a spacesuit, so that's still an issue with how the, how that one work. I look forward to seeing that one explained. I'm like, she was able to get to the moon on her own. Okay, that's an interesting...
Should not be human. So she is a mysterious character, that's right. We don't yet know who she is. She's a Thor who's wearing a mask. So we don't know who she is, but she's battling the Frost Giants in issue 4. And Thor shows up to reclaim the hammer in the midst of her battle with the Frost Giants. And they fight. And one of the things, and again, I don't know kind of the comic, you know, the power of the hammer, but apparently she's able to get the hammer to do things for her that Thor Odinson could not get the hammer to do for him. So by the end of their fight, he has realized that, you know what, actually the hammer, for at least the time being, does belong to her. And in fact, he believes it so much that he actually voluntarily turns over his name as well. He's like, I am no longer Thor. You are Thor. I am Odin's son, and that's it. So that kind of answer, my theft of lost property, is, you know, because of the unique properties of the hammer, she would not have been able to return the hammer to Thor Odinson if he had been the rightful owner. And really, since the hammer gets to decide who it belongs to, she is now the rightful owner. So there could be no theft of lost property. Now, Josh, I know you had a different spin on that that then ties in kind of to my issue 5 issue.
Which is fascinating that we both approached it from slightly different points of view. And it might stem from you're a newer fan and I'm an older fan in how we track the analysis, because we want new fans. So like, I'm very supportive of that. I'm not one of those angry geek guys. It's like, now there are people here who didn't read for the last 30 years. Well, good.
Thanks, we're not,
yeah, we're not shrinking. We're not dying. We have new people. It's okay if somebody doesn't know about Beta Ray Bill. It's okay. So my thought process, because I remember Beta Ray Bill. I wasn't reading when he was introduced in the original Thor series, but my thought process is, one, the hammer has a mark of appropriation on it with the inscription, whoever holds this hammer, if he be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor. And the new Thor was so worthy, the inscription changed to she, which was cool, and they didn't go with the like more gender neutral pronoun of they.
Right. So,
whatever. That's cool. So, but when Thor dropped the hammer, my point of view on this is being worthy is a condition precedent to being able to use the hammer. And so he might have still had a property interest in it, because a hammer should be a chattel. It should be something that's owned. However, since this is a comic book, we have it's quasi-sentient. It doesn't speak per se. It doesn't communicate directly with specific language, but there's obviously some intelligence that's connected between the user and the hammer that can direct how the hammer flies and other parts of this. So in my theory, that we have a revocable transfer of property contingent upon worthiness. And when Thor Odinson became unworthy, he lost his property right in the hammer. Now, under traditional property law, normally when that happens, it would revert back to the original owner. In this case, it would be Odin. Not the case that we have here, since Odin is also unworthy. So my point of view is, from the basis of the inscription, since the hammer can select its new owner, that the hammer became the property of whoever was worthy to lift it after Thor Odinson lost his worthiness. In this case, that would be the new Thor when she went to the moon and rightfully reclaimed her hammer, which I'm sure there are property professors and contract professors jumping up and down right now with the way that we just applied contract law and threw in a little Genvi Rich with that bomb lance on a whale and applying it to the hammer of Thor. So I think this is fun. I mean, analytically, this is like a lot of fun to look at.
It is. See, I was going to say, I think maybe the reason you approached it from a different standpoint than me isn't because of our comic book geek side. It's because of our law side. You just brought up a whole bunch of property words. And basically, the second my property exam was over and then whatever I had to learn for the bar was over, I forgot all things property. As much as I love law school, love constitutional law, love contract law, I was fine with torts and civil procedure. I hated property law. I'm like, if I never have to think about personal or real property or, you know, any kind of, yeah, any of that sort of stuff, no. So I think that's where I, even in my analysis of geeky stuff, I'm like, I'm staying away from property law.
Yeah, I did okay in property, and I think Professor Coletta would be very happy with what I just rattled out. Property was the first class I walked into in law school. So that was the first class in my section. So that was the one. And I remember whales and bomb lances because of my sailing interest. So,
sure.
So, and I actually found what a bomb lance looks like at Mystic Seaport in Connecticut. So
Mystic Seaport. You've been to Mystic Seaport? I went to high school and lived right near there. So we hung out at Mystic Seaport all the time.
Chappaqua Falls. Yeah, that's I just learning new things about each other.
Look at that. See, you guys, we've known each other for years, and look at what we're discovering. It makes sense that you would go to Mystic Seaport, though. Did you get to pull on the sheets, haul up the sails?
No, I was there for, we were doing a Sea Scout regatta at the Coast Guard Academy, and it was an advanced.
Which is right there in New London, Connecticut.
And it was an advanced trip out to do prep work, meet with folks, and I went like I'm not going to Mystic Seaport. So I, you know, was there. It was a day early, and so okay. I went to Mystic Seaport, and then I went to the Submarine Museum and went to the Nautilus because, like, I wouldn't do those things. I mean, seriously. So.
Well, that was my old neck of the woods. That is too funny. And now you've totally made me miss Connecticut. So, aw.
The more you know. So.
All right. I think that's a very good analysis. I will say my one other thought, kind of in reading issue 5 then, with the great and misogynistic Odin, who I'm like, has he always been such a misogynistic pig? Or are they just really emphasizing that now because of the whole female Thor thing? But, obviously, he's totally obnoxious, but, you know, he's very upset about the new Thor having the hammer. And so that got me thinking, okay, you know, is there any way you can revoke a gift like that? Can you make a gift and then go, wait, I didn't say it was okay for you to pass that gift on. And obviously, there's challenges with that. In general, you know, the law has said, no, a gift is a gift. And once you make a gift, it's done. Some states, including Minnesota, have recognized that you can make conditional gifts, but that almost, while some of the language sometimes is kind of more abstract, that's generally applied to engagement rings or other gifts given in, you know, in the thought that you're going to get married. And there's a whole idea that, well, you know what, you give this very expensive piece of property to somebody because you think they're going to be, most of the time, I guess, your wife, maybe husband, who knows. But anyway, you know, if the marriage falls through, should you have to return that gift? And so there has been a carve out for that, but I don't think that would be applied in this situation. So.
Yeah, that's why I went with the revocable transfer of property.
Right, I like that.
I think that legal theory is more on point. But property law is not designed to deal with weapons that can determine who owns them. The law isn't designed for that. And I don't remember Odin being this obnoxious.
Yeah.
In the old series. I mean, Odin could be a jerk, but he was still the all-father and normally kind of reasonable and sacrificed himself in fighting Sulfur. And so there's, like, not all bad. So they seem to be ramping up him being a jerk and bringing in his brother, the god of fear, called Borson.
Yeah. So,
like, whoa! And who's, what, the Minister of Justice? Yeah, that's... It's like, this is going to end badly. And just imprisoning the soothsayers, like, right out of the gate. It's like, wow, that is Not
You
a,
are a stereotypical bad guy in every single way.
Yeah, which is not the Odin I remember. And so,
oh, well, maybe there's more to that story then too.
I think he's just super angry. Super angry, which again doesn't excuse it, but it seems to be a pretty big shift in personality.
Well, from, that means, oh, go ahead.
From my childhood memory. So yeah.
Yes. Well, I do have to say, regardless of that, I am enjoying this series very much. I have to say it is, you know, there have been some others that I've enjoyed. She-Hulk, I like the Spider-Womans, love Wonder Woman. But Thor, I'd say, has just been fantastic so far. So I can't wait for the next issue.
Yeah. Upon my return trip from the comic book store, the first two comics I read were Thor and then She-Hulk in that order.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, there were other good ones in the past 2 weeks that, you know, that came out from my last trip to the store. But those were, I mean, fantastic writing, lots of good stuff. And, you know, there's a third comic that has had wonderful legal issues. And why don't you kick off that discussion?
I was going to say, we're now going to turn to a comic book that I don't know anything about. Presumably everything is leading up to, I guess, this summer and a movie that, again, it's a Marvel movie, so I'm going to see it even though I know nothing about the hero. But you've been talking about it a bit, and so because of you, I'm learning a little bit, but we're talking about Ant-Man. And you've been reading the current storyline that they have going for Ant-Man. Do we know, is this tying into the movie at all?
No, but when you're launching a movie, you obviously have to make sure that there's a comic book series going with it if you're going to support it, unless
right.
you don't want to support it and therefore you cancel Fantastic Four. That whoops, was that out loud? But Ant-Man by Nick Patience, my God, it's so good. So they're on the second issue, and for those who aren't familiar, there have been three Ant-Man. So the first one's Hank Pym.
Is that the one that's played by Michael Douglas in the movie?
Correct.
Okay.
And his voiceover monologue in the preview with, you know, there aren't second chances, be the hero that your daughter thinks you already are. It's like, oh, hell yeah. This rock on, dude. Yes, more. I want this movie. And you know, Scott Lang, you know, his reaction of, it's like, pure Marvel, rock on, absolutely.
It is. And Paul Rudd, love Paul Rudd.
Oh, it's going to be so good. Initially, I was like, I don't know about him as Ant-Man. And then the preview, it's like, yes, I'm on board.
Yes.
So the series, which is written by Nick Patience, we're on issue 2. And when the Avengers series ended multiple years ago, called with Avengers Disassemble, Scott Lang is killed.
Okay. Well,
they resurrect him because, again, you can't have the main character dead at the time the movie comes out. So they resurrect
right.
him. I'm not quite sure how he's resurrected. Well, Lang was a criminal. He robbed in order to make sure his daughter could get some medical treatment and to get a special doctor out and rescue this doctor in order to do this heart operation on his daughter. And that's how he ends up with the Ant-Man suit.
Okay.
And Hank Pym lets him keep it.
Okay.
So we're fast forward. So the first issue has all kinds of legal issues associated with child visitation and the ex-wife finding out that her ex-husband came back to life and wants to spend
yes,
time.
Yes, that would be weird.
Well, she does something that I think is like really mean with like, oh, I'll just move from San Francisco to Miami and say, screw you. I don't want you near our daughter, which raises all kinds of like child visitation rights. Mm-hmm. And I find family law especially heartbreaking and really, really unsettling. So I wanted nothing to do with that. I didn't
yes,
research
agreed.
It. It's just too painful and involves kids. And it's just like, I don't want to touch it. Issue 2 is a love letter to civil procedure. It is, and it comes from two panels, and I don't think Nick Patience intended to do it, but my God, it was beautiful. So what happened? Lang is starting his security business, and so he does a roadside.
In Florida.
So
okay.
In Florida, he does this road sign billboard for, you know, his business. And in it, there's Iron Man's image saying, I'd hire him. Because in issue one, Tony Stark was going to hire Ant-Man for security.
Okay.
He does not for a variety of Ant-Man declines for a variety of reasons so he could go be near his daughter, which is the right thing. But he never actually gave actual notice saying, like, yeah, I'm not going to go do this, Tony. So that would have been the better
way.
That
was poor business relations, yes.
So horrid. So when Stark's lawyer shows Stark the sign, a picture of the sign, the order to the lawyer is sue. Stark's in San Francisco. Ant-Man knows Tony Stark lives in San Francisco. Where is the right place to sue Ant-Man?
That's right.
This is first year civil procedure. This could be a bar exam question, and it is glorious because there are multiple options for this. You could try suing in California because California actually has a very specific statute about using somebody's likeness in advertising. And that came about, I believe, in like 1999 after the Claymation Brisk commercials that had the deceased actors in them dancing.
Okay.
I think it came about from there, or it came about what's actually been known as the Jennifer Aniston Law. I'm not sure which was the genesis of it, but I think it's one of those two. And I could be wrong. But that's okay. But anyway, this is a really good statute to sue him under because Stark could disgorge profits that were made because of that advertising.
Okay.
So in one theory, you could try suing in California saying Scott Lang knew about this and California's long arm statute might be able to claim personal jurisdiction over Ant-Man in Miami in the state of Florida. It's a stretch.
It is hard because, of course, generally the standard for personal jurisdiction, even if the statutes allow it, like, because there's two things you have to make for personal jurisdiction, right? The state's what's called the long arm statute has to allow it. How far can you reach to sue somebody in your state? Usually, though, the big test is whether it complies with due process. The Supreme Court over centuries, a century and a half, has said basically there's certain things and you need to have a reasonable expectations that your activities could result in you being hailed, as they call it, into court in a specific jurisdiction. So when Scott's doing stuff in Florida, should he have a reasonable expectation that he could get sued in California? And obviously you don't want to be sued anywhere, but being sued halfway across the country makes things a lot more difficult and expensive for you.
Exactly. So that's the first part of the analysis. It's a gamble. And it might not work because a California state court judge might go, so there was one road sign, but there was knowledge? And like, it'd be an interesting fight. And,
yes.
And Iron Man's lawyers would put up one heck of a fight.
Yes, but I think they would lose on that one. That one would be hard.
The better plan is to sue in Florida federal court.
Yep.
With federal question jurisdiction because it's copyright.
And which is a federal law. That's right. Sorry. Yes.
Federal law, and it's exclusively federal. And so
yeah.
You get into federal court by using Iron Man's image on the billboard. You can then bring in through supplemental jurisdiction. I don't think you could do both. I wouldn't try doing both, but you could use Florida's false advertising laws, which are different than California's.
Yeah.
So they are different because it's not truthful advertising, and you could bring that in through supplemental jurisdiction.
However, which is supplemental jurisdiction is bringing state law questions that really the state court should decide, into federal court by saying, Your Honor, we're already here for other reasons, so let's go ahead and address the state law issues too while we're here. And the idea there is, again, just that way the parties don't have to have lawsuits in two different courts.
Yeah, it's the same nucleus of facts.
Right.
So why litigate twice? Through ancillary jurisdiction, which is a form of supplemental jurisdiction, you could argue the California claim should come in as well, based upon either a form of diversity. The case in controversy might not be enough to actually meet the $75,000 plus 1 cent requirement, but there's a little case law that says that doesn't matter. And it was in a copyright case. So it's like, So there's a chance Stark could successfully sue, definitely on copyright, but he might be able to bring in the California claims in federal court in Florida. He definitely could bring in the false advertising claims as well. I don't know if they could do both. I wasn't able to find a clear answer on.
Well, I guess the question, that's a separate issue because then it's what law applies, right? And that's the choice of law analysis. So should Florida's laws apply or should California's? The odds are probably Florida's laws would apply, not California's, even though the plaintiff is in California, I would guess. But choice of law analysis is a whole complex area. And I loved that class in law school, but I remember by the end of that class, this is really hard and there's a lot of analysis to do.
That, and it could be a false conflict and as well, because they both, California's law and Florida's law speak to different things. And so there's an analysis there. I don't know what would win. Florida is the easier battle.
Yes.
Florida's the much easier battle. California does have the better law, though, on this issue.
And that is often what plaintiffs have to figure out when they're suing, is where can I sue the defendant and where do I want to sue the defendant? And there aren't always a lot of options. You can't just go suing anywhere. Nope. But there is sometimes, and that is often the tricky part. There was even, going totally off topic for a second, a book about called The Billionaire's Vinegar about one of the Koch brothers, not the one behind all the political things, but this whole thing with wine that was being put up by this German guy, probably forgeries, but he's claiming they were Thomas Jefferson's wines left behind in Paris, yada, yada. And basically, the end of the book, it tells about Koch, who's a billionaire, is trying to sue the German guy, but he wants to sue him in New York. And so he tries to do stuff. They try to fax things to Germany from New York, trying to get jurisdiction over this German citizen in New York. And basically, it ended up not working. So even when you're a billionaire, you can't sue where you want. You still have to have the, you know, required ties to that court. But it was a good book. A little bit too long, but a good book.
And I know about that case. So, that being said, lots of great stuff in comics right now.
There is, and I have to tell you, because I know there's some law students who watch our video posts. In fact, I just met one. It was very exciting. I will tell all law students, I did not appreciate it enough while I was in law school, civil procedure. That is the thing that you live and breathe if you're going to be a civil litigator after you get out of law school. And so I'm like, if you're thinking about being a litigator, please pay attention to Civ Pro, because I did not pay enough attention. And that is the thing that you really, day in and day out, need to know forward and backwards.
And that was my highest grade my first year of law school. I was 1 point behind the student who amjured the class. So that was it. And I ended up actually working for the professor my third year of law school, doing a lot of research.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I'm, again, e-discovery geek. Yeah. What's that tie to?
That's true. You're right.
Federal rules of civil procedure. That's crazy talk.
And we have shown a ton of our nerd side tonight. Forget the geek side. We're full out nerd tonight. But we do say Marvel keeps on doing the awesome comics. I want to hate them because they're taking over the universe and taking over Hollywood, but it is actually, they're awesome.
And well earned. I mean, when you're on top, you're on top. And they are, they're doing a phenomenal job with all of their properties right now. So keep up the good work. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight to hear about civil procedure and property.
What are you going to say, Josh? What's your sign off? I was about to say it for you.
Stay geeky, America. Stay geeky.